honourable member. We are about to start. As you know that today we are going to have the response to public hearing submission by the department. And thereafter, I'm sure honourable members will have an opportunity to have a question of clarity and comments. Honourable Deputy Minister, you are welcome.
Apology
taken. We will not waste any time. We'll go straight to the presentation by the department. DG?
The Chairperson and honourable members of the committee, once again it is a pleasure for the Department of Military Veterans to appear before the committee in pursuance of the process to have the bill before the committee passed by Parliament. We are here today to provide the responses of the department to the submissions made by members of the public who appeared before the committee to indicate to the portfolio committee what the department's take is on the issues raised by members of the public and the stakeholders. Chairperson, honourable members, let me first start by saying the department indeed commend. We commend the submissions made to the portfolio committee. We were following very meticulously the submissions as they were made to the committee, and our overall impression is that there is general support for this policy intervention by government, and we are quite encouraged by that. And also to add that what is also encouraging is that in the submissions made to the committee, there are matters that improve the quality of the intervention that we seek to make. And with respect to that, we have noted that there are matters that are raised by the public which in our view are going to be better dealt with in the long term aim of this department, which is that we intend introducing a white paper for a broader public discussion and debate on government policy with respect to military veterans. And in our view, some of the issues raised will better be dealt with in the white paper on military veterans in the long term. Because they are very well-placed concerns. And maybe in the course of the responses that we are going to present here, we may have the opportunity to comment on some of those issues. Before I give over to the DG to present these responses, I, however, want to take opportunity of this session, advantage of this session to help, to further clarify what the problem is that this bill is intended to address. And to also indicate that there is possibility that some of the aspects of this bill will become clearer into the future because we need space and time to communicate. We need space and time to communicate. Let me say that the community of military veterans that we are talking about is a community of people who were full-time soldiers. I think that logic is implied in the way we define what a military veteran is and why there is a need for government to assist this military veteran. I'm raising this because prior to 1994, we know that the South African Defense Force, SADF, of old, was managed on the basis with respect to human resource provision on the conscription system. And the conscription meant that all citizens, when they reach a particular age, have to do national service. Now, when we talk military veterans, we are not talking about all those who have done national conscription, then, because the whole country will almost become military veterans in that system. We are talking of members of the permanent force, people who were full-time soldiers. Because conscripts, I mean, in the system of conscription, where people do national service, they do national service and return back to their civilian life. So their national service does not in life disadvantage them such that we can say the department and government should now intervene to help them be reintegrated into society because they do not, among others, have skills on which they can eke a living. Matter of fact, the citizen force that was in place as part of the resource provision of the South African Defense Force of old was made out of people who were holding jobs, who were part of the civilian population. So when we talk of military veterans, we are talking of, in the context of the old South African Defense Force, we are talking of members of the permanent force. And it is probably something that has not been obvious in the things that we have said before, from what I picked up from the write-ups in the media by those who are trying to assist in taking out this discussion out there to the public. The other point, of course, which we need to clarify is that we have in the operation of the South African National Defense Force today a principle that the South African Defense Force is run on a one force concept. Now, the core force concept speaks to the fact that the South African National Defense Force is made out of the permanent force and the reserve forces. We have the permanent force and we have soldiers who are also part of the defense force, but who are not permanent in boots and uniform, but who are members of the reserve force. That they are members of the reserve force, members would be aware, does not make them non-soldiers. Last year we passed an amendment to the Defense Act that sought to allow the Chief of the Defense Force to deploy the reserve force at any time, even outside a situation that would refer to as a state of war. To allow the reserve forces to be deployed as and when the Chief of the Defense Force needs them, including even in peacekeeping. Now, what that means is that the reserve force members, in our definition of who is a military veteran, they do not constitute part, because they are very much part of the active force. Until a person goes into retirement and is no longer part of the reserve forces, it's only at that point that he qualifies to be a military veteran. That is important, because if this clarity is not established in this discussion, there will be an assumption that military veterans include members of the reserve force, and the reserve force is part of the active force that is in service. I thought that this helps us to bring clarity in establishing the size of the population that we are talking about when we talk about the military veteran. Lastly, Chairperson, the point I wanted to make is that we are today making submissions to provide the department's responses to what was presented to you by members of the public. We hope that in the dates that you have, and I have seen them, that you have identified for future meetings of the committee to finalize the discussion of this bill, we'll have the opportunity to come back as the department and indicate to the department what do we have subsequently, as you were dealing with the bill here, what as the department we have established to be technical improvements that we can still make to the bill to make it more readable, or that to make it easy reading to whoever lays his hands on this document, but also to make sure that some of the issues that we have raised in the bill, the formulations are improved and better capture the essence of the policy as it has been enunciated by Cabinet through the report which was shared with yourselves. Because there are indeed, we have observed, areas of the document, of the draft that you have before yourselves that can still be improved. And we hope that we'll be able to come back to the committee and indicate those. They do not speak to the substance of the bill. They speak to the a better presentation of the policy as captured in the bill presently. Those are the remarks, Chairperson and Honorable Members, that I wanted to make before I hand over to the DG to present our responses to the submissions by members of the public. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Deputy Minister. DG, we are in your hands.
Thank you very much, Chair, Honorable Members, Honorable Deputy Minister. With that introduction and overview that the Deputy Minister has provided, we'll go straight into the responses of the Department of Military Veterans and the Ministry of Defense and Military Veterans to the issues that were raised in the public hearing as occurred over that period of 29 to the 31st of March 2011, 11 years after the Military Veterans Affairs Act was actually passed. We do appreciate, as the Minister has already indicated, the opportunity to present the useful response inputs that were made to the bill in the public hearings by different organizations, sister departments of state, and so on. especially including the Department of Health, Transport, Human Settlement, Social Development, on the implementation of the bill. And we've also taken note of the comments and inputs that were made by the Honourable Members of Parliament during the time of the Portfolio Committee hearing. We deal with these issues that arise out of the bill and seek to follow an approach that highlights the specific issues that have been raised by the public hearing, and then what our response is to those issues. firstly, to go straight into the specific sections, and I'm now on slide number 4, which spells out sections 1, 2, 4, 5, 8, 9, 11, 13. And of course, it's those sections that are specific to issues that were raised in the public hearing. And also what our responses are with respect to that, to those sections. Now, firstly, with respect to section 1, as indicated in the bill, section 1, honorable members, deals with the definition. And right from right there, the first matter that has been raised was the concern raised relating to the definition of military veterans. And of course, an input by some organizations in the public hearings that the definition of military veteran should include non-military veterans, specifically those who may have been victims of apartheid and so on. And that is amplified specifically in the input that were made, in particular by groups such as the Kulumani Support Group, and so on. Now, the response that we have formulated and put before the Portfolio Committee is that this is a specific bill on military veterans, and underline or even bold and emphasize military veterans. So therefore, it will deal and seek to deal exclusively with persons or groups of persons that are regarded as military veterans in accordance with the definition in section 1 of the bill, which then says that a military veteran is any South African citizen, and then go through all of those definitions, who render military service to any of the military organizations, statutory and non-statutory, which were involved on all sides of South Africa's liberation war from 1960 to 1994, who served in the Union Defence Force before 1961, or became a member of the new South African National Defence Force after 1994, and lastly completed his or her military training and no longer performs military service and has not been dishonorably discharged from that military organization or force. So we seek to retain and propose strongly that we should narrowly confine the definition of military veteran to what is contained in the bill, as I've read to you, so that we do not extend that definition for the inclusion of non-military veterans, because by doing so, it would result in the expansion, significant expansion, of the scope of the bill and deviate from the policy standpoint. Furthermore, it will also have quite a significant impact on the national fiscus in terms of the targeted population who should benefit from this. Similarly, with auxiliary services personnel, well, the view that this should be dealt with in another legislation, and therefore finally recommend that the bill should not emphasize, not extend its scope to include either non-military veterans or auxiliary services, but strongly restrict itself to military veterans as in accordance with the Act. Even if at some point there may be a wish to tinker with the definition of military veteran as indicated, well, the strong view that it should still be restricted to only those that serve. The second issue with respect to, and that is on number six, slide number six, relates to the issue in the definition of a military veteran. The clause within that definition of a military veteran, which refers to dishonorably discharged, as mentioned in the definition. Our response to that is that and of course the context to this was the submissions that were made to the effect that that particular provision or phrase should be removed from the definition, the provision or phrase of dishonorably discharged. Now, the response that we'd like to proffer to the committee is that the provision should be retained, and the understanding should be that in such cases where a military veteran or somebody claiming the status of a military veteran and who is denied such status because they were dishonorably discharged should have recourse to an appeal board, which is established in accordance with the provisions of the bill. So that avenue is one that should be utilized for such members. And of course, it is acknowledged that there are indeed those members of the former forces, especially in the early part of the integration post-1994 onwards, who still strongly feel aggrieved that they were dishonorably discharged or even constructively dismissed, or the view that those matters should be dealt with in the context of the appeal board that will be set up. The third issue still within the definition of the military veteran relates to the issue of proof of legality of the dependent, and in that context, we're saying that will be dealt with in the regulations in terms of providing for the requirements of documentary proof of such dependence. And even if we may enhance it in the regulations, but we'll also be relying on the general application of the definition of dependence in accordance with other existing laws in the country, whether in the context of a dependence in the context of the Social Assistance Act or any other act that are existing. Furthermore, still on the definition, and we're on seven now, the matter of completed training within the definition, the issue that was raised was that the understanding is that the training must have been completed before one may qualify to be called a military veteran. And the question was, would this cover those who could not complete their training? And would they then be called a military veteran? Of course, we concede that this may create some confusion as to when does one qualify as far as training is concerned. But the proposal is that we would look at that with the view that, as proposed, look at the inclusion of people who may not have completed training for reasons beyond their control. For instance, somebody who may have incurred an injury or a disability during training. And of course, the other matter was with respect to clarity on the role of military veterans in the SANDF. And the response to that, as already indicated in the introduction by the Deputy Minister, is that military veterans play no role in the SANDF. And to emphasize that a military veteran is one who no longer has any active duty commitment. So they are neither in the full-time force or permanent force or in the reserve force of the South African National Defense Force, which means they have totally discharged any responsibility to serve in the South African National Defense Force. And this should also be read in the context of the amendments that have already been passed by yourself, amendments of the Defense Act 2010. Furthermore, still on section 1, in the definition, the matter of dependence The concern in this regard is that the definition may exclude the dependent of a deceased military veteran in the current form in which it is couched. An insertion was suggested to be included to read or at the time of a military veteran's demise. And of course, that picks up on the definition of a dependent, and in the bill it reads, dependent in relation to a military veteran means any person who is dependent on that military veteran for support and maintenance. We are of the view, having examined this, that the provision should be retained as it is, as it covers the dependence of a military veteran after the commencement of the act, not at a certain time of a military veteran's life. Still on section 1, in the definition, the concern was in terms of the general imprecision of the definition of military veterans, and that there may be an exclusion of other former military forces, or that there needed to be a specification of the military forces that have been spoken about within the definition. We had indicated already, even in the policy framework that we brought before Parliament in September 2010, which laid the basis for the bill, that the status of being a military veteran is conferred by virtue of having had participation in the military, and as the definition of the military veteran already says, all of those different categories in A, B, and C under the definition military veteran. And as you will note, that is the longest definition in the Act and under the definition. So, therefore, those who may have integrated and then exited the SANDF after 1994 to date are and should be considered as military veterans. And of course, the rights that are being imposed in the bill will accrue to individual members in their personal capacity as having qualified to be a military veteran. So they would then qualify even if they may no longer be members of the former forces. In time to come, we will not speak of former forces, but military veteran will apply. Simply, the definition, most likely after our lifetime, will simply be those who served in the military. On section 2 of the bill, and section 2 is with respect to the interpretation of the Act, and the issue in the public hearings that arose was, what is the purpose of having a clause on interpretation of the Act? And the response that we have is that in legal drafting, it is critical to have a section that deals with the interpretation of the Act, so that there is no ambiguity about the interpretation of the Act and also the constitutionality of the Act. And hence, the interpretation of the Act clause reads very firmly that the Act must not be interpreted as entitling any person who is defined as a military veteran in the Act or his or her dependents to any benefit provided for or any other law merely on the grounds of such a definition. So that is the context in which the clause on interpretation of the Act was inserted, so that we assist the reader in interpreting properly that Act, so that it is very clear what is the status of being a military veteran or being a dependent. On section 4, honorable members, section 4 of the bill deals with the authority of the president. And the section on the authority of the president, as captured in the bill, provides that the president is the patron-in-chief of the military veterans. Now, it was realized and is considered that the title of the section on authority of the president, it seems to make the president the patron-in-chief only, and there is nothing else that is described beyond that. We fully concede and agree with this assertion that the provisions do not address the president's authority, but only deals with the president as the patron-in-chief. and therefore recommend that the heading should be amended to read patron in chief, and then to then go on with the wording that is there, that the president as the commander in chief of the South African National Defence Force is the patron in chief of all military veterans. Moving further with respect to Section 5, and Section 5 is the section that deals with the benefits relating to military veterans, all 10 of them, 5.1a up to J. Now, the first concern that was raised in the public hearing was with respect to the accrual of benefits, whether the benefits are meant for a military veteran and or their dependents. The response to that is that the benefits as specified are for both military veterans, a military veteran and dependents, if they satisfy a means test. So you may have an instance where a benefit may be applicable to a military veteran but not a dependent. So both are beneficiaries but may not qualify for all or every benefit as listed in Section 5. And some benefits are applicable to all military veterans, for instance, that particular one on honoring and memorializing, whilst others will then go on the means test and the needs of each military veteran. Still on Section 5, whether a military veteran can receive a military pension, as indicated, still the same in that section, on pensions, whether a military veteran can receive a military pension or another benefit in terms of the bill. And our response to that is that the means test will determine the extent of benefit, but yes, a military veteran may receive a benefit over another benefit over and above the pension or a military pension as specified. So, over and above that. Now, finally, on Section 5, other issues relating to benefits are with respect to age, why is the bill silent on imposing an age limit with respect to the receipt of benefits, silent on the issue of age and also benefiting? The response to that is that a military veteran's eligibility or qualification for a benefit is not based on age or disability, but on means test results. Now, the context of the question or the public hearing input that was made with respect to age was that in other pieces of legislation, age does play a factor, and in particular, the Special Pensions Act was mentioned as a case in point with respect to that. In the context of the Military Veterans Bill, a military veteran does not qualify because they are young or old, but because they have passed the means test as prescribed in the regulations, and the same would apply to their dependents. So we therefore recommend that the provision should remain. Honorable members, on Section 8 of the bill, Section 8 deals with the Director General's functions in respect of the South African National Military Veterans Association. The concern with respect to that 8.3a of the bill is that that particular provision that says that a military organization is not obliged to join SAMVA, the response to that is that that provision entrenches the constitutional freedom of association as entrenched in Section 18 of the Constitution. And also that military organizations have the right to associate with the association of their choice, and therefore we recommend that the status quo be retained with respect to that clause in Section 8. But furthermore, still on Section 8, in terms of the recognition of forces, the suggestion is that the bill must recognize the former forces or forces mother bodies, so to speak. And this was a particular submission that was made by the Azanian People's Liberation Army Military Veterans Association, we sought to say that the bill must recognize the political organization that the Military Veteran Association belongs to. Now, the view that we have is that the bill does not speak to political parties directly, but speaks to the military forces that existed prior to 1994, and also the existing South African National Defense Force. So, therefore, it is individuals that are regarded as military veterans due to their military participation as defined in the Act. So their status, if we're talking about prior to 1994, is more historical than their affiliation to political parties. So therefore, we recommend that the status quo should remain. On Section 9, with respect to the functions of the association, the concern with respect to the formulation of this clause, as reflected in the bill, is that the functions are similar to what is reflected in number Section 11, further down, Section 11 of the bill, which speaks about the advisory council. This concern is noted. However, there is a difference with respect to these two clauses, and therefore there are no duplications. And we have the view that we should retain both clauses, because Section 9 deals with the association in the context of the national military veterans association, while Section 11 deals with the advisory council, and the two are different. The advisory council is the advisory council that is established by the minister, established, appointed, and put in place by the minister to do all of those things that are spelled out in Section 11, whereas Section 9 is more about the National Military Veterans Association. Furthermore, on Section 10, with respect to, again, the Advisory Council, the proposal from the public hearing was to the effect that there needed to be equal representation of the former non-statutory forces in the Advisory Council. It is our view that the principle of having equal representation is not necessary, because already in the establishment of the Advisory Council, it is clearly stipulated that the Advisory Council will consist of 10 members, three of whom will come from the National Military Veterans Association, and then the rest would then be appointed by the minister in accordance with eligibility for appointment to the advisory council. So, in terms of those that would be forwarded by the National Military Veterans Association, it is incumbent on the National Military Veterans Association to ensure that those who then do get forwarded to the advisory council are fully representative of the constituent elements of the National Military Veterans Association. With respect to Section 13, similarly still on the appointment, the concern that arose was that there seems to be a restriction in Section 13.2a, in that it restricts membership to military veterans only. And to just reiterate to the Honorable Committee, Section 13.2 reads as follows: members of the Advisory Council, A, 2A, 13.2A, must be military veterans, and B, must have relevant knowledge, experience, or expertise that would enable the Advisory Council to perform its functions effectively and efficiently. We are in agreement with the concern raised, and we will look at how we then reformulate that and look at removing that particular restriction. Of course, there may well be people who are not military veterans, but whose expertise and knowledge we seek to start from or also obtain, and that may be members of the advisory board. Honorable members, on Section 20, with respect to the establishment of the appeal board, Section 20 establishes the Military Veterans Appeal Board. There was a submission by a group of doctors who are dealing with the military veterans that there should be a medical appeal board to deal with either medical complaints or appeals on the basis of whatever applications that have been submitted in the context of the Military Pensions Act. That proposal has been noted. However, we are of the view that it is not necessary to establish a separate board, but that since the appeal board is already in place, that should be used as a vehicle to then deal with this matter, because the appeal board would be a multidisciplinary board that would include the medical profession, the personnel, and therefore would then be able to attend to any matter before it. But furthermore, in the Military Pensions Act of 1976, as amended, there is also a provision for an appeal board within the context of that act. So even as later on, there is an examination of amendments to that piece of legislation, because we will need to look at other legislation in terms of how it impacts on military veterans and when necessary to then effect amendments. In conclusion, Chair, Honourable Members, we welcome once again, as the Deputy Minister indicated at the very beginning, the input that has been made during the public hearing period, written and verbal, and that overwhelming view that the bill must address the needs of non-military veterans, we've already addressed that, but that finally there should be an understanding that the rights that have been enshrined in the bill are essentially socio-economic rights in nature, and therefore will be achieved not all at once, but progressively, depending on the availability of resources, also within the context of the clauses on socio-economic rights in the Constitution, that is Section 26 to 28. We conclude that, Chairperson, Honorable Member. Thank you.
Thank you, DG. Honorable members, now it's your time. You may interact with the areas that you need clarity, areas that you have questions on, and areas that you would want to comment on. Honorable Menya.
The second is also related to a statement by the minister, and that is in respect of the definition of military veterans. And that, again, I welcome the fact that the minister put this issue on the table, because we do need to grapple with it. The minister said that in terms of the definition of military veterans, former members of the SADF who were national servicemen are excluded from that definition. Now, this, in my view, may raise a constitutional problem. I mean, how is it that a SADF national serviceman, for example, who served in the SADF for 2 years and who finds himself destitute, is inferior, for example, to a member of MK who served for 2 years and also finds himself destitute? Does this not raise a constitutional problem in the sense that both these individuals participated in a political conflict, both are destitute, and under our constitution they ought to be treated, in my view, equally? And this is something, Chair, that we may need to, in my view, take a legal opinion on. And that's obviously a decision that through you, the committee, will take. But I think this is an issue that we might need to examine. I'm not a lawyer, but I would be very interested in a legal opinion on this issue. So that's the second question. The third question relates to a previous statement by the minister in his budget vote. And that was, this committee has dealt with the very thorny issue of the financial implications of the bill. And if I recall correctly, the minister stated in his budget vote that the cost or the financial implications of this bill have been substantially reduced, and I think over the MTF have now been recosted at about 1.6 billion rand. Now, I would be interested in how that figure was achieved. But in my view, the savings could only accrue through, if you like, positive changes. But I think that we need to re-examine this question of cost. If the department have a revised costing, then I think this committee should be briefed on that costing. The last point is not a question, it is a comment. But Chair, during this process, several departments were given the opportunity to comment on the implications of implementing this bill for their departments. I mean, you will recall that at least three departments, health and social development, seemed unprepared to implement this bill, and you will recall that the Department of Transport did not seem to have heard of this bill. Again, in terms of our processes, I would like those departments to possibly for you to consider giving those departments, particularly the Department of Transport, another opportunity to present to this committee. So, three questions and one comment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
I hope that I spoke loud enough for my honourable comment.
Honourable Masango.
Thank you, Chair. So I've got also two questions for the Deputy Minister. Sorry. The Deputy Minister spoke about some aspects of the bill will be clearer as time goes on or as time goes on. And I'm not really clear. Are we going to pass something that we are also not sure of? We'll only understand it. I mean, sometimes we have to explain to the people, what does this mean? If you say it will become clearer as time goes on, then I have a concern. We have to have it clear before even we pass that bill, because we cannot have it while we are not clear about it. The other question you spoke about, that the department will come to us as we are busy. We will be starting with a deliberation on the bill. I think it's from Tuesday the 31st. And I'm not sure why should we carry on deliberating on every aspect of the bill if the department itself is going to come with some technical aspect that they are going to explore. Why don't we have you first doing it, and then we'll deal with that at a later stage? The other question that I want to ask, we are talking about the regulation, but I'm not sure what will the regulation look like. But I'm just being worried about the age on dependents. We are not saying, we're saying the age is not a factor on the dependents. And how are we going to deal with this thing if age is not a factor, especially on dependents? because I mean dependence is just too many dependents. If we're saying we're going to take the dependence also to a mean test, I'm not sure. I thought the mean test is only meant for a military veteran, not a dependent. But the last one I want to also just raise it is the same that David has raised. Some departments came to us here, and there are no response from those departments, because some departments actually couldn't give us what are they going to do with regards to their own benefits that they wanted to assist the military veterans. And we still need to hear what will be that they are going to offer. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister.
Chairperson, thank you very much for the question. Let me start with the first questions raised by Honourable Member Mainier. I recall in this committee indicating that there is a possibility that we may introduce a white paper on military veterans. So I was not aware that honorable members would be hearing this for the first time, that we are announcing that we contemplate doing that. Right from the beginning, I think this matter about the white paper has been very much part of the explanation why we went the route of getting a task team that came up with the policy recommendations and took the policy recommendations to cabinet, and cabinet endorsed them, and we set up a department. We're explaining that process in the context of the normal convention in government when the new policy is introduced, that the government will introduce a white paper before, and that we decided not to go the route of having a white paper before we established this department, because the president decided when he appointed the executive after the elections of 2009, that the Department of Defense would become the Minister of Defense would become the Minister of Defense and Military Veterans, and the question, the responsibility to attend to military veterans was immediate, not something that was going to be waiting for a white paper, hence the minister decided that there should be a ministerial task team set up that will come with policy recommendations that will serve as a framework. The Department of the Minister of Defense and Military Veterans will use in serving the community of military veterans. And we said that it is quite possible that in time we may actually introduce a white paper, because what does a white paper do? A white paper allows the broader public to be involved in a debate and discussion of policy, and the time frames of the white paper, you know, are very, you know, generous and very lax. So what I'm saying, what I said earlier on, Honorable Member Mainier, I thought did not constitute a new view communicated to the portfolio committee by the department. But the second point on process, there's absolutely nothing unprocedural in the establishing of the Department of Military Veterans before a white paper. Nothing unprocedural about it. The new departments that have been established. The department got established in government, and they're not established on the basis of white papers or on policies that were an outcome of white paper policy, you know, discussion process. That we have a department in place and already responding to the needs of military veterans and in the long term going forward wanting the public to have a, you know, the opportunity to make its own input about how better and how best military veterans should be served is absolutely procedurally correct. Absolutely procedurally correct. There is there's no violation of any conventions with respect to that. The second question was with respect to yesterday's what the honorable member referred to as servicemen, meaning the conscripts of yesterday, that it would appear unconstitutional that they should not be referred to as military veterans. The definition of a military veteran, the first category of people that it refers to is people who were members of the military organizations that were involved in the conflict of the past on all sides. Members of those organizations, they were provided for by all the organizations that were part of the integration process. Now, the SADF has not, in submitting a CPR list, presented all the South Africans who did national service as its members. SADF would have presented members of the permanent force as members of the South African Defence Force, for the simple logic that national conscription does not make citizens members of the Defence Force. It's a national service. That's one. But secondly, the reason why government says the military veterans constitute citizens who were disadvantaged as a result of the service they provided, and government becomes obligated to help them move on with life, it is because these people were full-time soldiers. Now, members of people who have done national service as conscripts, they're not full-time soldiers. You go and do your national service and proceed with your studies, university, and or you go and do national service and still hold your job after that. So the disadvantage, I do not see how it can be tested, but I do not see how the Constitutional Court would find any logic, in the problem that you are. Identifying and how it would come to a conclusion that all South Africans who have done national service are military veterans and therefore deserve to be assisted. So, the second point in relation to this matter which you are raising, you are saying if a member of the, a South African citizen who did national service today is destitute and according to the means test would actually deserve support by government, would that not be discrimination if we do not do so? The point is that the condition or the circumstance that he is in or that he ended up in cannot be logically traced back to the responsibility of the state. Matter of fact, I mean, in life, you know, we don't all succeed to be the people we want to be. I'm talking, you know, material, you know, material conditions. And the government can't take responsibility for all of us as a result of that. I mean, there is a very huge degree of individual responsibility with respect to the case that we are putting. Unlike non-statutory forces members, because with non-statutory forces members, we are talking about people who are full-time out there. Unlike permanent forces members, we are talking of people who are full-time soldiers there. So I think the comparison is it's not quite consistent. Yes, I don't. Not very much helpful.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you very much. thank you very much. That would be my response with respect to that. The third question was about the costing of the bill. How did we scale down the costing of the bill to be the 1.6 billion that we spoke about in the budget vote debate of defense, and when the initial, you know, figures were huge without a change in policy? Could this imply that there's been a policy change? Well, there's been no policy change. No policy change. Matter of fact, the reason why I actually felt that I should come to the portfolio committee when you were discussing the costing of the bill, it was because the figures that you were provided with were preliminary work. We actually said that the costing of the bill that we'll provide to the portfolio committee cannot be costing of the bill that has not gone to cabinet. But for some reason, the department decided to cave into the pressure from the committee that you must provide the costing of the bill now, and they gave you figures that were actually, which were actually which were not, again, which were not helpful. Which were not helpful because it was work in progress. It was work in progress. And we have explained this to say we brought the bill to Parliament without the costing of the bill because it was difficult to actually work on the costing of the bill in time the way we would have wanted to and the way we are expected procedurally to do, that when we submit the bill in Parliament, it should be a costed bill. But precisely because this was a problematic, you know, undertaking, we are unable to do so. But because of the pressure of the committee, the department then brought material here which was work in progress. We have actually indicated I assumed that the information behind or the details of the costing of this bill has been shared with yourself. I assumed. The 1.6 billion. If it was not shared, it's not confidential information. The costing of the bill must be with the portfolio committee, and I assume that the final costing of the bill was presented, and how we arrived at 1.6 billion, it should be you know, something that the portfolio committee is aware of. If it has not been provided, it's something that we can do immediately. But let me just explain what accounted for the huge differences. The costing, the figures that were brought here as the costing of the bill was a costing whose logic said, what will cost government to look after this population of military veterans from now when the legislation come to force to the end of their lives. Now, there's no costing that, you know, in government, you know, it's based on that kind of logic. I've never come across it. Maybe you can do it, and if you try to be, you know, very smart in planning, but the kind of planning that involves such long time spans. I mean, the world keeps changing. So the usefulness of me coming up with a costing that says how much is it going to cost you to look after this population until all of these people are dead, it's a bit too adventurous in my view. But that is what the costing, the 65 billion. Was it 65 billion? Something like that. But I don't know the figure because I've never interacted with those figures. That was work in progress. And the costing of the bill that we took to cabinet and which the committee must have here of 1.5 billion is the costing of this policy in to government over the MTF period, because that is how I mean planning, financial planning in government is done. The longest projection of plans of budget in government is the MTF period. So we have done that costing for the MTF period, the entire cycle of the MTF period. It is 1.6 billion. So there's been no change. If I may now, you know, recap, there's no change in policy of this bill that has led to the drop in the costing that we have provided. The problem was in the concepts used in the working out the projected cost to government of this bill. And I thought be aware that roughly on an annual basis over the MTF period, this policy is going to cost government, let's say, plus minus 500 million. The budget of these benefits in government is going to be plus minus 500 million on average across the MTF period to the outer year. On average. The departments that align function machineries in government to deliver some of the benefits that you are talking about have not been heard by the portfolio committee. Well, if it is a decision of the portfolio committee that they want to hear all of these departments, by all means, well, it is your judgment call, but we, as a department, in working out the cost, we have convened a meeting where all these departments were present. We have interacted with departments. I don't know who says that we have not spoken to these departments. We have invited these departments to the meeting. Transport, education, social development department, they were part of, matter of fact, I was sitting in the, I chaired that meeting, they were there. But I'm saying that if the portfolio committee wants those departments to come here to hear, if you want to hear them yourselves, maybe you are not so convinced about what we are saying. Look, you are our bosses. We can't say no. It's your own prerogative. You don't know that the parliament is in this country constitutionally on these matters of policy the pillar of our democracy that is that we all defer to. I was simply making that point. Now coming to the questions by Honorable Member Masango, he says that the point I made earlier on that the issues raised in this bill will become clearer with time. I mean just that, Honourable Member Matang. The issues raised in this bill will be clearer with time, as with any other bill, with any other legislation in government that comes into force. Matter of fact, there are some of the legislations in this country that many citizens are not so conversant with. Because I was saying that we need more time to communicate. We need more time to communicate. The citizens need the space to interact with this provision in government to actually understand it better. Even if we were to, you know, go full throttle for a whole week in communicating about this bill, people may still not all of them understand what is involved. So it is in that context that some people will have impressions about this bill's objective and what is now available in government, which impressions will only be dispelled when they actually now go to the Department of Military Veterans and say, I want this and this and this and that, and they realize, no, the policy does actually not say that. It says something else. So the point I was making about who is the problem, who is the part of the problem this policy in government is intended to attend to, I was saying clarity may not necessarily be available out there that this does not include all South Africans who have been through national conscription. But not that there is no clarity in the act, in the draft. Not that there is no clarity in the formulations we have in this bill. There's clarity there, but what I'm saying that to members of the public, for instance, this bill does not say what actually we are talking about. This bill does not say that all South Africans who have done military service, conscript, who have done national conscription, must be military veterans. It doesn't say so. Matter of fact, it does not say so. But clarity will emerge to other people with time as they interact with this policy, with this government policy. There are so many government policies that I'm very clear that even members of parliament are not necessary. It depends on what sector you work in your legislative work that you may not necessarily be clear with. Why not wait until we make the submission that I made reference to, that there are improvements to some areas of the bill that the department would want to recommend to the portfolio committee. I've indicated that the improvements are not with respect to the substance of the draft, but they speak to technical issues. They speak to formulations, better formulations, If the committee says, you know, the next meeting should be, that presentation would be ready to do that. But we did not want to come here as the department and lump together our water responses to the public and then and smuggle in some other changes that we ourselves are proposing that you must consider. We want to make a clear, you know, distinction between the two, so that you must make your own, you know, things, judgment, you know, properly. But the issues are very technical. For this, I give an example. The bill, there's a section of the bill that enumerates the benefits, and it has left some burials, for instance, and things. It's not there. Things like that, you know, those kind of, they're technical, you know, corrections that we must make. But as I'm saying, the committee, the chair can indicate to us when should we come with those matters to yourselves. On dependence, can I leave that to the DG to respond to the issue on dependence? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Deputy Minister. DG?
Thanks, Chair, Deputy Minister. The on the dependence, the Honourable Member Massam wanted to know the issue of age as a factor in terms of the dependence. The dependence, the definition that has been used, is a generally applicable definition in current legislation elsewhere of a dependent, which then means, even though here we've said dependent in relation to a military veteran, is any person dependent on that military veteran for support and maintenance. This may include the child of the military veteran, it may include the spouse or life partner of the military veteran. So as to the matter of age, if it's in the case of, for instance, a child, the applicable legislation would then be in place in terms of up to when would that child be regarded as a dependent of the military veteran. For instance, if the child is already over 18 or is already over 21, whichever is applicable, as is the case in other legislation or other policies. Let me give a concrete example. With respect to the benefit in 51A on access to healthcare, 51AI, the Department of Military Veterans has already started with the delivery on that particular benefit. Now, in the context of a dependent, if we are looking at that matter of access to healthcare, as already applicable in policies with the South African Military Health Services, which is the one that is actually providing such access to health care, once a dependent of a main member, in this case we'll say a military veteran, but otherwise a member who is in service in the Defence Force, which is 18, that then access to health care terminate unless if there is a proof that that dependent is still school going, and that proof has to be submitted on an annual basis until such time that they are no longer there. So that matter then can be dealt with. That.
You done, did you? Thank you very much, Honorable Deputy Minister and the DG. Do we have any other comment, Honourable Member? Honourable Menia?
Thank you, Chair. These are already simple comments. On the question of the exclusion of so-called SADF conscripts, I wonder if the state law advisor, who I think is in our midst, would perhaps want to express himself on whether indeed he thinks that there might be a constitutional problem. Nevertheless, I mean, I think to you, Chair, that we should get a legal opinion on this from the parliamentary legal advisors. I also think that as soon as possible we should receive a briefing on the final costing of the bill. We have not yet received that final briefing. And I do think before we proceed with our deliberations, Chair, we should get a re-briefing from the line function department, who will be responsible for implementing this bill, so that we can satisfy ourselves that they are in fact ready to implement it. The impression created in the previous round of briefing, particularly from the Department of Transport and Social Development, was that they were not ready to implement the bill. And as I said before, in the case of the Department of Transport, seemed not to have even heard.
Now, honourable members, you must remember that the department that did not understand as to how to structure the presentation were asked to go and upgrade their presentation and submit it to the portfolio committee. I've seen a number of them doing that. What we should do, we must just communicate with the committee secretary and check as to whether the all of them did submit those presentations. I think we must take it up from there. Then, As to other members, honourable deputy, other matters, honourable deputy minister, those are matters of advice. Not, I don't think it's something that needs a debate now.
Okay. No, thank you, Chair. If I may just, with your permission, Chair, if I may just say something with respect to the issue on line function department. It would be extraordinary to do what the honourable member ministers must happen, that the committee must call departments who are line function, I mean departments in the rolling out of the Spanish here, in order to establish their readiness to implement this this legislation when, I mean, when passed. There's no legislation in Parliament that is passed on the basis that the government is ready to implement it. Departments are ready to implement it. There's no legislation coming that you pass the legislation and then from there, matter of fact, upon acceding to the legislation by the President, the time lead to the legislation actually coming into force by with the department government machinery implemented, at times it can be, you know, quite a long time lag. So, just a matter of principle, I'm not sure if it is procedurally correct that you, as a portfolio committee, would want to pass legislation because you have satisfied yourself that government is ready to roll. No, I've never heard of a thing like this.
Hello, Dr. Lagin.
I want to agree with the minister, chairperson. That our duty, our function as a portfolio committee is to pass legislation, recommend the parliament to pass particular legislation. And once that legislation is passed into an act, which of course the president will have signed, assented to, department will have to carry out whatever is in, embodied in the act. The minister, deputy minister is correct. We never pass legislation on the basis, first of all, that all other line function departments must say whether they are ready to implement it or not. Once it has been passed into an act, they are bound, simply bound, to implement that act. It's like the point raised earlier by my friend here. He said, why discuss this matter when we are still waiting for other things to be done first? You know, an act, a bill, it is like a resolution taken by any organization. You pass a resolution and you can never know whether that resolution is correct or not until you have implemented it. Once you have implemented the resolution, it's only then that you know that we should have said this, we should have done this. It's only then that you realize mistakes, if there are any, once you implement the resolution. It's like an act. Hence, it's being amended. Because we did not foresee that when we passed the act, when we passed the bill. So later on we say, oh, yes, when implementing this act, there's something missing. Therefore, we have got to amend this act so as to accommodate that which is missing.
Honorable Maria. That's all. Honorable Maria.
Yeah, thank you.
You will follow Honorable Maria.
Yeah.
my view was that the department was going to present to us the analysis of the public hearing. So, and after presenting to us the analysis of the public hearing, we will then seek clarity where we seek clarity, and thereafter ask the question whether in view of the submissions from the public hearing, is the department going to look at those that they think should be included in the bill, or either ourselves, are we in the position to suggest to the department to have some of the submissions included in the bill, so that by the time we discuss the bill, we would not be discussing the bill making reference to the other document, which is the submission of the public hearing. Now, the question then for me is to check with the department if the bill before us, by the time that we will be discussing it, by the 31st, are we going to see a different document, or are we going to see the same document as it was presented when it was labeled to Parliament? And if we are going to see a different document, for us to be able to then prepare ourselves that on the 31st, we'll be seeing a different document, but then continue proceed with the deliberations in terms of legislating, rather than getting deeper into some other areas which were raised partly, of course. Because my view is that the areas that the Deputy Minister has presented here, he was presenting them in passing. He was not presenting them for discussion. Yet we are curious, of course, to understand in terms of his own view, the time frame, and what is his way forward in seeing them implemented. But the truth is that we have got a bill before us, and that is the bill we need to deal with. And in that bill, all we need to know is whether the impressions from the submissions are going to appear or not. I think that's my case, Chairman.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mazia. Honorable Mania?
Chair, just on my first point to you, I would be interested again in hearing whether the State Supervisor would like to express himself on the question of the definition of military veterans, excluding so-called SADF conscripts. And then just a final point, I see that the Honourable Trangian likes to fire without checking whether the gun is loaded. I think that Parliament does have a duty before passing a piece of legislation to ensure that, in fact, the legislation can be implemented by the executive and can be afforded by the executive, and it's precisely for that reason that there's an obligation to cost bill. I like to check whether the gun is loaded before I fire, not the other way around.
I'm not happy with the explanation given by the Deputy Minister.
I'm not happy with your interpretation of our
role. Right. I think we are going to come to an end of our meeting. And, Deputy Minister?
No, Chair, I don't think Honorable Member Meniri is correct to be persistent on this matter, because there's really no point that he's trying to argue here, in my view. Parliament, in passing legislation, and actually this, you must I don't know if he's aware, the Honourable, that it has actually not always been the practice that the bills, when they come to Parliament, they come costed. That has actually been not been the case. Parliament passes laws. Parliamentarians, public, the representatives of the people, bring here the sentiments of the communities they represent, and they, on their understanding of the sentiments of the members of the public, on the understanding of the sentiments of their communities, they decide what they would want the country, how they would want the country to do things, and they put that in law. Matter of convention, in the past, it has not always been the case that parliamentarians even worry about budgets. All they say, we want this, is what we want, that is not what we want, we want this, we don't want that. The problem of budgets has always been the problem of the executive arm of the state. But we're getting, you know, sophisticated as a country. Parliament passes, in order, parliamentarians say, in order to pass a law, we want to see, we want to satisfy ourselves that the country has the resources to back up that policy. And that's it. Not that the administration machinery is ready to execute. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way. It does not work that way. As a matter of fact, it does not work that way.
Let me show you.
It doesn't work that way.
Chair, when we pull the trigger and it doesn't fire, we
want to
want.
I just want to raise a question as a matter of interest, more especially pertaining to Sanskrit. I know in a normal employment environment, if you are a temp, you don't subscribe to teacher skills. You only subscribe to the unemployment insurance fund. Now, as a conscript, because it is not full employment, it is it was a normal service for, what do you call it, for disciplinary upliftment. Of the youth, even though it was a forceful arrangement. Now, I think we need to know then, that if we are hard fast to say that they need to benefit, on which basis? Because they were not in the payroll as such, but they were there on a, not on a service, but what do you call it? As not said,
national service.
National service. So,
description, national service.
Yes. Now, as not said, I don't know the name of the program itself, but my common sense informs me that it was not full employment. It was like you are doing a temporary service, but it was a temporary service to your benefit, not necessarily to the benefit of another person. And you were not subjected to certain other responsibilities which are subjected to a member of the board. So why should we think that they must benefit in this legislation?
No, the matter, I don't want us to dwell anymore about it. Ordinarily, when the department drafts the bill, they will always say it's normal. They will always check at the constitutionality of the matter. That is what should happen in any case. So it's not a point for debate. Now, then, we Honorable Deputy Minister and the DG, if there are any technicalities in terms of drafting the bill, it will be in our appreciation, the appreciation of the Portfolio Committee, that we should receive the redrafted, even before we go to the drafted bill, even before we go to the deliberations. And then I hope that will not give you any problem. You'll do it for us. And thank you very much for your presence here. And honorable members, thank you very much. And let's meet again when we deliberate. Thank you very much.
I'm not going to be able to do that.